University of California Television presents this podcast of Conversations with History, featuring Walter Russell Mead discussing U.S. foreign policy and the American political tradition, recorded in February 2003. UCTV's Conversations with History series is hosted by Harry Kreisler, director of UC Berkeley's Institute of International Studies. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Walter Russell Mead, who is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a leading interpreter of the history of U.S. foreign policy and America's role in the world. He is winner of the Lionel Gelber Prize for his book, Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World. Walter, welcome to Berkeley.
No, it's good to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in South Carolina in Columbia, but I was kind of raised in a lot of different places. My dad's an Episcopal minister, so we kind of travel from town to town. But until I was in the South until I was 17.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, a lot of different ways. We were in the South during the Civil Rights era, and my dad was one of the Episcopal clergy who was very active, marched with Martin Luther King, and both my grandfather and my father were involved in desegregation efforts in the places that they lived. And, I mean, there were some real confrontational situations. A lot of people didn't welcome the changes. And I think that experience of seeing that kind of social change close up, it's shaped me profoundly, not always in ways I understand, but to see how a society can believe, segregation is right, and a lot of good, honest people absolutely saw nothing wrong with that. And yet, it was a terrible era in history. And watching people change their minds and learn, it was something that is always with me.
Where was your schooling?
Well, when I was 13, I got a scholarship to a prep school up north, Groton School. And my scholarship included 3 round-trip bus tickets a year from North Carolina to Massachusetts. I said I was the most bused kid in the South. I mean, talk about busing. It was a 17-hour trip. And Groton was and is a very well-known prep school with a lot of very rich people there and a very distinguished history. And I was from the South. I didn't know nothing about any of that stuff. And so I had to kind of learn to sink or swim up there. I did some of both.
And then you did your undergraduate work at Yale?
At Yale, right.
And in this educational journey, did any teachers or mentors stand out as really sort of shaping your thinking?
Well, I was lucky to have great teachers along the way. And in fact, Special Providence, which I've dedicated to my teachers, I mentioned 5 men by name, Bruce Cooper, who was a 7th grade English teacher, and I think really exposed me to literature in a new way. A couple of history teachers I had at Groton, a guy named Doc Irons, who's mentioned actually in The Best and the Brightest, because he was George Bundy's high school history teacher as well. And David Halbersham has a couple of pages about Doc Irons' teaching methods, which had not changed much from the 1930s to when I had him. Acosta Nichols, a history teacher, who, among other things, at Groton, what he would do is every now and then we'd get to the point in history where some boy's family had made their money, often by rather nefarious ways. And Mr. Nichols would kind of take the kid aside and say, well, now, let me explain to you how your father, how your family made its money. People did a lot of complaining about war profiteers in World War I, and... And then at Yale, a man named Richard Broadhead, who's now the dean of Yale College, taught a phenomenal seminar in American Studies. So, yeah.
Yeah. And you at Yale, you majored in literature.
That's right. I took a lot of history and American Studies courses, but I wanted to read and read literature. I belong to book groups and we read novels. I still probably spend as much time reading literature as I do anything else.
And is that an important way to get a handle on a civilization or a culture?
I absolutely think so. I think that understanding the poetry of a culture, certainly understanding the language of a society, gives you an understanding of what Hopkins would call the inscape of a culture or a people. And I do find that that many people in the field of foreign policy who've had only kind of an academic or political science training sometimes lack a feel for the reality of a culture or a people. Since I've come to the council, we've started, just begun recently, trying to do things like take our staff over to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They have a exhibit this spring on art of Central Asia. And just to try, again, to see this stuff, to get to enrich the foreign policy making process with more of an understanding of cultural issues and cultural realities.
We'll talk a little bit about foreign policy in a second. What got you interested in foreign policy?
Well, like I said, I was always interested in foreign policy. I grew up in the Vietnam era, and in fact, McGeorge Bundy, fellow alumnus of Groton, was on the board of trustees of Groton at the time. And he was, as a national security advisor in the Kennedy-Johnson administration, he was one of the architects of the war. A lot of my friends' parents had important roles in that war. So in a negative way, seeing that, I realized, in a sense, how important foreign policy is for people. Mm-hmm. And when it goes wrong, what kinds of devastating things can happen. I think for a long time I wanted nothing to do with foreign policy. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, that's just how you go make Vietnam wars, and I don't want to do that for a living. And there's also the thought of, boy, you make a mistake and a million people die. Like, how great, maybe you should go to a profession where you make a mistake and the pizza isn't that good that evening or something. That kind of responsibility. So I really sort of shied away from that for a while, and only gradually did I begin to think, well, on the other hand, there's sins of omission as well as sins of commission. And if you feel like you have a talent for something and you're not using it, maybe as much harm can come that way.
And before you got to foreign policy as a field of study, what sorts of things did you do after you got your degree?
Well, I taught for a while. I worked in a federal anti-poverty program in Massachusetts. I edited a labor union newsletter in New York City. I wrote my first book, Mortal Splendor. Basically, by day, I was doing temp work in a Kelly Girl, essentially, and doing word processing. And at night, I would work on my book. Mm-hmm. So I really sort of knocked around. I felt that graduate school wasn't the right place for me. There was a lot of, I still wanted to be a generalist and wanted to read literature, but I didn't want to be an English critic. Mm-hmm. I wanted to read history, but I didn't want to be a professional historian learning a very specific set of skills. And actually at the time, there weren't that many places that taught that. Mm-hmm. I think there may still not be very many.
Probably less if there were any.
Right. They want to turn you into a member of a profession rather than giving you a kind of a broad background in the history and culture of your society and others. So I just couldn't find a match between my aspirations and the way the educational system worked. So I decided, well, I'll save the money and just do the reading and stuff on my own.
So, but you came back to foreign policy studies. So first of all, tell us, why is the history of U.S. foreign policy important?
Well, most people in the foreign policy field would agree that you don't study the history, you don't study the foreign policy of any country without trying to understand the historical context, so that you wouldn't try to understand, say, the politics of the European Union today without understanding the history of Franco-German relations, the history of British relations with France and also other countries. You wouldn't try to understand Russian foreign Putin today. You wouldn't try to understand him unless you knew something both about Soviet foreign policy and pre-Soviet Russia. Yet most people come to the study of American foreign policy without that historical context. It's as if 1945 were the year zero, or maybe 1941. Before that, we were in virtuous isolation.
Or in the Garden of Eden. Maybe.
Right. Yeah, we didn't think about the rest of the world. The rest of the world didn't think about us. And then suddenly, there we were in the middle of things. And, you know, that's just not true.
And why is this history so misunderstood both at home and abroad? That is, the history of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I think kind of hard to say, because a lot of our, you know, our country, people say, oh, well, Americans aren't interested in history. Americans don't pay attention to history. That's really not true when you think about it. I mean, the way we look at the Declaration of Independence and we say those principles are still valid to guide us today, the Constitution or the Supreme Court, we look at, you know, we still read John Marshall's Supreme Court decisions, and those are important to us. If you were to go to West Point or Annapolis, you'd find that they're studying the tactics of, you know, the Battle of Saratoga or John Paul Jones' sea fights. It's only in this one field of foreign policy that we seem to be so disconnected from our past. And I think some of it has to do with the politics of getting into World War II and the Cold War, that it was just sort of Roosevelt and the people around him, and then later Truman and Acheson and those people really just felt they needed to try to move public opinion quickly. And they couldn't fight the battle of dealing with this myth of isolation that we had. So rather than dealing head on with that battle, they just said, well, things have changed with the airplane, with technology, with globalization. We have to be involved in the world in a way we didn't used to be, and let's move from there.
You say in your book that there are three realities in our history that are part of what we have ignored until the present. And they are, one is the impact of foreign policy on domestic politics. One, the fact that we've been a global presence from the beginning, or at least have been concerned about what's going on in the world. And then thirdly, that our foreign policy has been very successful. Despite all of the agitation, say, in different periods in opposition to particular policies. So in doing the history, part of the task then becomes to recover those realities by showing what actually happened.
That's right. I mean, very few people know, for example, that trade was a bigger percentage of our GDP in the 1790s than it is today. It was bigger in the 1870s than in the 1970s. So a lot of this stuff of globalization as being new, it just ain't so. If you go back in the 19th century and you look at our stock market crashes and our depressions, they were generally caused by events overseas. You know, there's an Indian mutiny, and that causes the stock market in London to go down and interest rates to go up. Well, that meant, because of the way the world financial markets worked at that time, we followed London. So you'd have a stock market crash here because there was a revolt in British India. Or in 1893, Argentina, surprise, surprise, defaulted on its debts. And this caused, at that time, banks had lent a lot of money to Argentina rather foolishly. So the Argentine debt default set off a crisis in London, which again set off a panic in the United States. And these things were transmitted at the speed of light over transatlantic cables. So instantaneously, you were getting these kinds of results. Trying to recreate for people the ways in which the past was similar to the present, I think, is an important part of what a historian has to do and what a student of foreign policy has to do.
And one of the points that you make is that through the 19th century, we were very dependent because we were very much in debt to the outside world, and that changed, say, at the end of the 19th century or at the turn of the century of the 20th century, and that also affected our consciousness about the world. We really didn't need the world in the way we had before.
Right. In a lot of ways, America in the 19th century felt like a third world country, like a Brazil, where, you know, yeah, we were obviously a strong industrial power. Our economy was going somewhere. We had a future. But we were still dependent on outside capital. And so if interest rates went up in London, we had a depression here. And in those days, it was not the Federal Reserve System that set interest rates in the United States. It really was the Bank of England. And everybody knew it and felt it. So foreign policy was clearly, the foreign world was clearly intimately affecting your household budget all over the country. And people followed foreign news and had views on foreign issues then with a great intensity. Then in the 1920s and 1930s, they didn't as much, because by then, in essence, the Federal Reserve System was telling the Bank of England what to do more than the other way around. And so we were probably less influenced by outside factors in the 1920s and 1930s than in any other time before or after in our history. And that was when that myth of virtuous isolationism was created. People no longer felt that kind of dependency. And in those years, we were safer from foreign forces than we'd ever been before. The U.S. Navy was as strong as the British Navy by then. In the 19th century, the British Navy was much stronger than the American Navy. People used to, if you go up and down the east coast of the U.S. today, you see these enormous forts. They were built to protect our coastal cities from the British coming in and burning them down, as, of course, they burned Washington in the War of 1812. They occupied New York, Philadelphia, Boston during the Revolution, Charleston. And people lived with the potential nightmare that our cities could be destroyed. Only in the 1920s and 30s was there this island of serenity. And then afterwards, of course, you get with airplanes and missiles a return to this fear that your home could be destroyed in a foreign war.
Now, as you went about this task of writing, coming to an understanding of our foreign policy in the trajectory of our history, looking backward, you conceptualized it by talking about four schools or four themes that have been the core of the American dialogue on U.S. foreign policy. Explain how you came to that realization and what that realization was.
Okay, well, after I became increasingly aware of just how much important foreign policy had been throughout American history, I also started looking at the battles over foreign policy, and I realized that they actually don't change that much. You could go back to the George Washington's administration. There's this huge debate. Do we side with the French Revolution in a worldwide crusade for democracy, or do we, you know, realistically work with Britain to secure our economic goals? Do we try to stay out of the whole thing and defend our democracy at home when France or Britain does something that annoys us or insults our sovereignty? Do we retaliate by force or with diplomacy? The arguments that people advanced and the values that were at stake in those debates, you'll find them in the 1820s, 1830s, 40s, and all the way up to the present day. Or you look at the anti-war movements in American history. You look at Thoreau's opposition to the Mexican War. And for that matter, Abraham Lincoln was against the Mexican War. A lot of the arguments they brought up are very similar to the ones that Mark Twain and some of the anti-imperialists brought up in 1898. But you hear them again in the 1930s. You hear them again in the Vietnam era during the Cold War. And you've certainly heard them since September 11th. And they tend to be the same kinds of arguments. So what happened as I looked at all of this, I found that, at least from where I sit, these arguments were increasingly grouping themselves into four categories. And as I looked at those a little longer and tried to think about what the connections and differences were, I did come up with this theory, in a way, that there are four approaches, four visions of foreign policy of the national interest that shape the way Americans think and argue about the world.
And they are. Go over them very briefly.
Well, in no particular order, the Hamiltonian school, I name them after the heroes in American history. And I really try, by the way, in the book to be impartial, to try to describe each school really the way someone who belonged to that school would describe it, rather than saying, well, this is my pet school and I hate all the others and they're all stupid. The Hamiltonians are people who think the United States needs to become the same kind of great power in the world that Britain was at its peak. We need to have a strong economy. The federal government should be working to advance the working hand in glove with large corporations and great business interests to advance their interests in overseas trade. We should try to build a global order of trade and economic relations that keep us so rich that we can afford to do what Britain used to do, which is to keep any one country from getting too strong in Europe and Asia to affect our vital interests, to threaten us. And when a country threatens to take over either Europe or Asia, then we build up a coalition against them and bring them down either by peace or war. And that's been a vision that has moved a lot of people. Again, George Washington probably to some degree had this view of American foreign policy. Then you've got kind of its opposite, the Jeffersonian view, which says, look, the United States government should not go hand in glove with corporations. That will undermine democracy. It'll get us involved with despots abroad. We'll be supporting evil dictators because some American corporation has economic interests that are advanced by this. And also, this is going to undermine democracy at home. So I think, you look at somebody like Ralph Nader as a Jeffersonian, who sees the WTO as a corporate big government plot against democracy at home and democracy abroad. But at the same time, this Hamiltonian goal of a grand global order gets us involved in conflicts with people overseas. So we're involved in the Middle East, so people hate us in the Middle East, so they come and attack us, as in September 11th. If we'd never set foot in the Middle East, we wouldn't have this problem, say Jeffersonians. And again, that's the logic of anti-war movements, and we've seen a lot of Jeffersonian stuff over the generations. Wilsonians, I mean, I think we all intuitively know what that is. It's this belief in the United Nations, international law, that the United States should be pushing our values around the world and turning other countries into democracies, whether they like it or not. And the U.S. should also work multilaterally and in institutions. We should be supporting things like the International Criminal Court, Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and we should not be unilateralist in our approach. We should put human rights ahead of trade and so on and so forth. Then finally, you've got a group called the Jacksonians for Andrew Jackson. And one way I describe it is just to talk about an incident in American history that I think illustrates a lot of the school's value. And Andrew Jackson was a general in 1818, and he was fighting a war against the Creek Indians in Georgia. Florida at the time was still under Spanish rule, and there were two Englishmen in Florida selling arms to the Indians who were then attacking U.S. forces in Georgia. Jackson took the U.S. Army across the international frontier into Spanish territory without any permissions or any U.N. resolutions or anything. Went in there, arrested the two Brits, brought them back to the United States, tried them before a military tribunal, and hanged them. And this did cause outrage in Europe. They said these people have no respect for international law and so on and so forth. But it made Jackson so popular in the U.S. that his election to the presidency was just really a matter of time after 1818. And this kind of don't bother with people abroad unless they bother you. But if they attack you, then do everything you can. So in the 1940s, 30s, Hitler takes over Paris. We don't move an inch. He starts exterminating the Jews. We don't move an inch. Japan is doing all of this stuff all over Asia. And on December 6, 1941, any opinion poll in the country would have said that most Americans wanted to stay out of World War II. Then December 7th, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, and suddenly the polls change. Jacksonians, when somebody attacks the hive, you come swarming out of the hive and you sting them to death. And Jacksonians, when it comes to war, they don't believe in any of this limited war. They don't believe particularly in laws of war. War is about fighting, killing, and winning with as few casualties as possible on your side. But you don't worry about casualties on the other side. That's their problem. They shouldn't have started the war if they didn't want casualties.
So four schools, and I'm curious about the intellectual orients. Your intellectual orientation at the time you wrote this. The book was written in the 90s. The Cold War was over, so we had a groping for a strategy in the United States, where it wasn't clear what our relationship would be with the world, what would be the guiding things. And really, it's at this point that you're doing this study, mm-hmm. and in exploring this history, coming up with these schools and your notions about U.S. foreign policy. What was it like to then try to apply your notions to the world of the 1990s? Did that help you make sense of that world?
Well, it did. I mean, one of the big things about the 1990s for someone like me who had been around during preceding decades is that politics of foreign policy stopped being predictable. You know, in the 1980s, if somebody was a dove on, say, intermediate missiles in Europe or didn't like Reagan's policies in Grenada or Central America, you could be pretty sure that that person had been against the Vietnam War early on, had been a dove basically going as far back as the 1950s. And the same thing about hawks. You had hawks, you had doves, and that's what you had. And they didn't change, and you could... People during the Cold War tended to work with very binary systems of discussing American foreign policy. Internationalist, unilateralist, isolationist, interventionist, realist, idealist, hawk, dove. They sort of all boiled down to the same thing, and they didn't change. Then in the 1990s, things do change, and you have all these humanitarian interventions, you know, and you'd look at something like Bosnia or Kosovo, and you would see an alliance of hawks and old hawks and doves being hawkish on these, but also an alliance of old hawks and doves being dovish. Mm-hmm. So why were there ex-hawks now doves and ex-doves now hawks, but also some ex-hawks still hawks and ex-doves still doves? And I guess that helped me start to think about, okay, can you subdivide these realist, idealist, hawk, dove categories to try to figure out in a way, what would give you the new political combinations that you're getting. And that line of questioning got me to see, for example, that there's some, quote, idealists, Jeffersonians and Wilsonians, some of them favor a very muscular policy of expanding American values, and some of them just want to keep American values safe at home and don't want to run risks abroad. So that people who opposed the Vietnam War would disagree over Kosovo on that side, and so on. So what I found was that the new realities of the post-Cold War world demanded some kind of a more complicated typology.
And it was the case that if one didn't look back to the history, that one tended to see each case, a Kosovo, the debate over NAFTA, relations with China, as kind of distinct,
exactly,
discrete case studies with no overarching view of both what it said about our past or how it related to our past and what it might say about our future.
Yeah. Well, for example, in the revolutions of 1848 in Europe, the Hungarians threw off the Austrian yoke, but the Russians came in and crushed them. The leader of the Hungarian resistance, Kossuth, came to America. His tour of America was this amazing event. And, thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of people turned out. There was a demand that the president of the United States receive him. People wanted the United States to do something about the crushing of the Hungarian freedom movement. And in general, the crushing of the democratic revolutions of 1848. And we actually did send the Navy to Rome, where the papal forces had crushed the Republican forces in Rome. And we provided political asylum for the refugees of 1848. So we did end up intervening a little bit. But to listen to the Bosnia-Kosovo debate, you would never have thought. And believe me, the 1848 was not an isolated event either in American history. You would have never thought that these debates over humanitarian interventions are something that go back to the 18th century in the United States, and that in general, the forces and the arguments that advocate and resist these interventions tend not to change all that much over time.
Now, the price we pay for not understanding and having a feel for our past are many, and you enumerate them in a very interesting way. One is the bum rap that democracy gets in the debates about foreign policy. You go on to show how the ideal was continental realism with the balance of power. But in fact, there is a complexity and a richness to the way our messy process has produced this successful foreign policy. Talk a little about that and how these schools helped you kind of get a feel for that.
Right. Well, it's definitely true that if there's one thing that there's a near universal consensus about in American foreign policy, here and abroad, it's that America's no good at foreign policy. We're not as subtle and sophisticated as the Europeans, many people will say. Whatever the specific allegations are, some people say our foreign policy is evil and conniving. We're murdering human rights advocates in developing countries. Others say we're spineless and weak-kneed and can't stand up for ourselves. Everybody's got a different stick they want to beat American foreign policy with, but basically everybody agrees we're stupid and incompetent. And yet, if you really look at the last 200 years, it's interesting to ask, who's winning? You compare the United States with the other great powers. Who's gotten more of what they wanted? Whether we wanted the right things in a moral sense, that's another issue. But whether using this kind of realist idea of the world as a competition between states for resources and prestige and so on, who's getting more of it with less effort? It's clearly us. So it's very interesting when you find that the foreign policy of the world's most successful state has the lowest reputation of any state, really. Mm-hmm. And my sense of why that was true was that there's this idea that is very popular among political scientists that foreign policy needs to be made generally by a small number of people and that you have to have long-term planning. Metternich plans Austria's foreign policy over 30 years, and no one gets in his way. And if he wants to change alliances, he can. He doesn't have to worry, that the pro-French lobby will give him a hard time if he wants to switch to Prussia. He can just do it. And American foreign policy doesn't work that way. Secretaries of State aren't in there for long. Our process is unbelievably messy. Congress is constantly sticking its oar in. Mm-hmm. There's war between the different departments in the executive department. Everybody's fighting over it. And yet it seems to me because this messy process allows the four different schools and visions to be represented better in a sense that over time, our foreign policy our process seems to give a better result of defining and seeking the national interest than the conventional, more orderly process of pre-democratic states. And I make in the book the argument that other countries, as they've become more democratic, Germany and Japan being two very good examples, have gone from having absolutely disastrous foreign policies to foreign policies that work pretty well. Mm-hmm. So there's really an argument that democratic debate doesn't weaken a state, but strengthens it. And interestingly, the book is being translated into Chinese. Mm-hmm. And what I'm, you know, I think what I'm hoping, and maybe what some Chinese historians are hoping, is that this will help legitimate in Chinese debate the idea that a free public discussion does not divide and weaken China. Maybe that's a little bit of my inner Wilsonian coming out.
Mm-hmm. So that in fact you might hope that there are comparative implications for what you're describing, that although you have attached certain labels from our own history, that in fact you may have a comparable dynamic in other countries.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be identical. You know, the Jacksonian, they're probably every country has a kind of a populism. And in some elements, it may be similar to our Jacksonian populism, but it won't be the same. You know, for example, in Germany, public opinion is more deeply pacifist, and I think also in Japan, than in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So you can't just simply apply the American model. Countries really do have their own cultures and their own histories. It's also true in some countries, you have oligopolies or oligarchies of families who control the economic fortunes of a country. So there, the debate between Hamiltonians and other schools is also a debate about the role of an oligarchy. And while many times our rich have tried to form an oligarchy, they've rarely succeeded for long. The economy keeps kind of expanding and new power centers keep coming up. So the relationship of the schools is going to be different in different places. But as I say, if any large foundation out there wants to give me a big fat grant, I'm ready to undertake comparative foreign policy studies.
The virtue, it seems to me, of your school is that it gives those in the foreign policy debate in this country more hope that they might have. We have a tendency to see the road that we've just taken as the road that we'll always be on, so that once you get Bosnia and Kosovo, where the Wilsonians, one could say, have the upper hand, there is a sense, oh, my God, we're going to be intervening everywhere in the world to bring human rights and democracy. There's a disaster down the road. But what you're suggesting is that this very messy process with four identifiable schools suggests that that there will be a balance over time,
right,
and a reassertion of the virtues of another school.
Well, it's a little bit like our domestic political system. There's something in it that pulls people back toward the center. We may go herring off to the left, to the right, but ultimately kind of gravity reasserts itself. And I think, you know, I think it's clear, for example, that a lot of the voters were uneasy with what they saw as an excessive Wilsonianism, too many humanitarian interventions in the Clinton administration. And I think Kosovo in particular, where we found ourselves in this rather odd war with Yugoslavia, you know, thank God Milosevic caved when he did, because if he, you know, it's not clear that we could have gone on to the next step of ground troops or what would have happened. Mm-hmm. And so there was a sense in the country of wanting to pull back a little bit, and I think that was a factor in the 2000 election. So each school is, and you can also see, you know, George Bush is in and we have all this Jacksonian rhetoric and so on. There's a perceptible sense of unease in the country, not so much, I think, about wanting military supremacy, because I think, you know, you say to anybody, well, what country do you want to see being militarily superior to the United States? No one's actually going to give you, oh, well, China, I think that would be fine. Russia, Germany, whatever. But it's more the sort of way of insisting and beating the drum about it, or making a big deal out of preemption, rather than sort of saying, well, you know, obviously in the last analysis, any country is going to act to defend itself. but let's not get in, you know, let's not get into the details. But when you push it and you say, okay, this is going to be the foundation of our new foreign policy, people get nervous, and you can kind of see how the Bush administration keeps getting pulled back toward the Colin Powell view, even as the rhetoric remains very Rumsfeldian.
Which would be a Wilsonian view to a certain extent.
Well, Rumsfeld is kind of a mix of...
But I mean Colin Powell.
Colin Powell, no. I don't think Wilsonian in the sense of... I would call Colin Powell more actually of a Hamiltonian, like Condi Rice here. Hamiltonians, this gets, you know, Lodge, who fought Wilson on the League of Nations, was a Hamiltonian. They don't mind international alliances and organizations, but they don't think these organizations should have power over the United States, be able to veto something the U.S. wants to do, or be able to compel the U.S. to do something it doesn't want to do. Wilsonians think they should. Mm-hmm. You know, thinks that if France vetoes it in the Security Council, then we shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. Hamiltonians think the Security Council is terrific, but if you think we're going to let France stop us from something we think we need to do, that's ridiculous. So, but on the other hand, the Jacksonians say, why even bother with these stupid international organizations? They are just in the way. If you need to go get somebody, get somebody. So the Jacksonian position was, don't go to the Security Council for Iraq. The Wilsonian position is, you've got to go. And if the Security Council says, no, you can't do it, the Hamiltonian position is, it's probably smarter to go. But in the last analysis, if they won't go with you, you'll have to go alone. But don't do that unless you have to. And you can see they've been pulled, the administration has been pulled away from the Jacksonian position toward that more centrist kind of thinking.
One of your concerns in writing the book, I sense, is the failure of American leadership in the 1990s to have a scripture, so to speak, that they could work with as they shaped our future course in world affairs. You say the task facing serious students of American foreign policy and those who aspire to lead the nation is to find within each of the enduring traditions of American statesmanship ways to speak to the aspirations and values of the American people in order to win their firm and enduring support. Explain what you meant there.
Well, I'm one of these people who thinks that the 21st century is going to be a century of danger and conflict. It's very unpopular in the 1990s, but I believed it then, and since September 11th, I believe it more.
And you finished your book in July of 2001.
That's right. So the book is pre-September 11th.
Yeah.
But I don't feel really the need to change a word after September 11th. And in this world of danger, the United States cannot escape having an active and vigorous and, frankly, at times risky foreign policy because the world is a dangerous place. And our interests connect us all over the world in all kinds of ways. So the political leadership has to find a way to be able to, you know, the different parties, the different schools have to be able to argue foreign policy, and the public has to find a way of being able to say, okay, I believe you, or I don't believe you, and I trust you, and I am prepared to follow you. I think that's inescapable. In the 1990s, there was the idea that, you know, say Bosnia and Kosovo were never particularly popular, or the Haitian intervention or whatever, and foreign policy was driven to a certain degree by lobby groups, you know, that pull, you know, I want this and I'm an important constituency, so you have to give it to me. And there was the feeling that we didn't, you know, we were so strong and the world was so safe that you didn't really have to, and this is the first Bush administration, I think, as well as the Clinton administration. This is not an anti-Clinton diatribe here. But that you didn't have to think strategically, run risks, or get the serious, well-considered, profound support from the people that say the Cold War policies had.
Another question that you think is terribly important to discuss, debate, relates to a phenomena, a characterization of America that we fail to discuss, and that is empire. hegemony. And you say at one point, we need a debate about American hegemony and its meaning for the national interest. The New York Times reported the other day that if the new defense budget goes through, that our defense budget will be equal to all the defense budgets, you know, in the world. What did you mean as you wrote these lines even before 9/11?
Well, I meant that history has brought the United States to a certain position of influence and leadership in the world, and partly this is the result of our own choices in the past, and partly it's the result of others' failure or mistaken choices. From the standpoint of the average American family, is this okay? Should we try to become stronger? Should we actually try to be a little bit less out front and pass the buck? How do we even discuss it? You know, what are the alternative views and what are the costs and the risks? And what are our criteria for saying that something is successful or not? I don't think we have yet the kind of consensus that would give us the basis for the debates that we need to have. You're hearing a lot of, after September 11th, you know, there's some people who say, well, we're too deeply involved in the Middle East, and we need to, and maybe we're too committed both to Arab dictatorships and to Israel. We should cut back on all of this. Then there's some people who say, no. We're not involved enough, and we haven't really pushed enough. We should be really pressing the Arab world to turn into democracies. Then there's some who say, well, no, let's just kind of manage what we've got here. Dictators, democracies, don't bother me, but we need the oil, and we need our relationships with the oil powers and so on. Well, why? In all of those cases, what is your vision of the world? What are the likely consequences? What is America about in the world? And I don't think that our political leadership has yet been able to give answers to that. What is the kind of world America is trying to build? How much sacrifice for the average family, whether it's money, whether it's blood, whether it's living in fear of a terror attack, how much sacrifice are these goals worth? And I think the point of having a debate like this is to end up with a consensus, because we're going to actually, whatever we choose among all of these and other alternatives, we're going to have to stick to it and make it work. And choosing one thing means turning your back on other things. You know, if we build democracy, we're going to have to deal with both following through and foreign aid and stuff, but also we're going to have to deal with worse relations maybe with countries that aren't democratic, who maybe we need. On the other hand, if we decide to ignore democracy and work with dictators, we have another set of problems. We need, I think, a more informed debate about which should we do and why.
And really, implicit in your argument is that knowing the history, whether one disagrees with your interpretation of the history, really enriches that dialogue and gives us ideas about the decisions that go with the questions you just raised.
That's right. And one other thing I'd want to add to that is I think it will help foreigners understand us better. When one of the real sources of instability and danger in the world today is that foreigners really find the United States very unpredictable. And when you have a very powerful country and you have no idea what it can do next, this is very unsettling. And, you know, for example, again, in Bosnia and Kosovo, the United States public opinion did not want a single casualty, wasn't willing to go to war. Now, suddenly after 9/11, you know, the feeling is the U.S. is this aggressive military machine and God knows who they'll invade next or what they'll do. And they turned on a dime. Why? And are they going to keep going like this forever? I think if foreigners understood our history better, they would also understand the way in which we do keep our balance over time. And we are, in some ways, a fairly predictable power. I think that would make it easier for them to live with us. And that could, I think, make more fruitful forms of international cooperation possible.
What does your history tell us about our weakness for dealing with the world that we're going to face? Do we have any? And what are the corrections?
Well, we do have weaknesses. Each of the schools, in a way, has a weakness. You know, you can take the Jeffersonians wanting to stay fairly isolated from things. They have the tendency to ignore problems until they become overwhelming. Classic example, Japan in the 1940s. Then you've got, I think, the Hamiltonian approach, again, left to itself. You get a country that, you know, you get this globalization that we have that becomes universally unpopular around the world, and the U.S. is associated with neoliberal economics and taking food stamps away from hungry children in hundreds of countries and a corporate faceless bureaucracy at the WTO. And so, you know, you get people burning down McDonald's and stuff all over the world. That's not so great. The Wilsonians, I think, can be very rigid in wanting to apply ideals where they may be inappropriate. It's also clearly, it's a very tricky question. Do you impose your culture's values on someone else, and how do you do it? And when is it appropriate and when isn't it? And I don't think Wilsonians have good answers for those questions. And Jacksonians, this idea of ignoring the world until it does something you don't like and then going out and swatting it, well, that, you know, it means that your country is going to be militarily strong when challenged, but that alone is probably not enough. So what I would say is we need, the four schools need to be operating to keep each other in check. And each of them has strengths, each of them has weaknesses. I think, in a way, the war on terror is going to be a good thing for American foreign policy, because it has concentrated everyone's minds on foreign affairs. And there's a sense, unlike the 1990s, that this is life and death. We have to take this seriously. We have to approach it responsibly, make choices, act, and commit resources. You know, Bush is spending $15 billion on AIDS in Africa. This is tremendous. I think we're going to see more things like this. In the same way, during the Cold War, fear of the Soviets had us giving a lot more foreign aid than we would have otherwise. Maybe we didn't always give it wisely, but you can learn. So I think the war on terror is going to be one of those events that brings the United States to a higher level, ultimately, of a more effective foreign policy. And I think we're going to surprise both our friends and our enemies over time at how effectively we deal with this challenge.
If students were to watch this tape and they have an interest in foreign policy, either at study as somebody who works in foreign policy or as somebody who, as a citizen, wants to know more about it, what advice would you give them?
Well, I would say, first of all, study history and not just American history. Yes, study American history. Study world history. I'd also say get to know the United States. Particularly if you're going to an elite university like Berkeley or some of the private schools, and maybe your family is a well-to-do family and you've lived in good suburbs and all, you know, don't just think, oh, man, I should learn about foreign cultures and go to Nepal and smoke hashish, I'm sorry, study their culture for 6 months, or I should go to Europe or Africa or whatever. That's nice, and you probably should. But what about, like, going to Topeka and working as a waiter or a waitress for a summer? Working in a box factory, teaching public school in some ordinary white bread, mayonnaise-eating, lower middle class American part of the world to understand your own country. That's something I would advise. Then maybe more specific career things. I definitely say read The Economist. Probably read the Financial Times. Those are probably the best news sources in English. Read Foreign Affairs. Let's see, what else? There are, I think, increasingly going to be a lot of job opportunities in the field. There are a lot of corporate opportunities for working overseas. I think there's tremendous opportunities in the U.S. government for young people, foreign service, something people may not have considered, but military careers. I run across a lot of military officers who've gotten advanced degrees paid for by the U.S. government, people who have had extremely interesting careers and, you know, and do quite interesting things. I would not rule that out if I were a young person. We at the council hire a small number of kids just out of college to be research associates working for people like me, which I'm sure is a pretty hideous job in many ways. But it is a chance to find out how people in the field operate. One of the tough things about our society is you get educated in schools. Well, basically, the people that you meet there, the adults you meet there, are people who know how to do one thing, which is work in schools and universities. So making that transition from the educational world to the, quote, real world is actually one of the toughest things that people have to do.
Is it fair, in for a final question to conclude, you said at the beginning of this journey that you were sensitized to the myths that hid the way we really were with regard to racial relations in this country. And you then also became sensitized to how things could change. That seems to be a theme that you have carried to your foreign policy work. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think I'm now half a century old and have seen an awful lot of change and an awful lot of things that people took absolutely for granted have disappeared or turned into their opposite. And it's very easy to be involved in the tyranny of the present and to think that the ideas that are fashionable today, the institutions that are powerful today, the cultural norms that are dominant today are going to last forever. They aren't going to last forever. And so as an individual, you have to try to find some way of orienting yourself in a world of constant change and upheaval, some values that you can live by, a grounding in a history that is bigger than just the history of your own life. I'd say you're right.
Walter, on that note, I want to thank you very much for writing this book and then also coming here to tell us about it and also lecturing to our foreign policy class.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun, and thanks for having me.
Thank you, and thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.